நீ மாண்ட நீ காணியின் பாட்காஸ்ட் நீ குவச்சு சிந்தமேக்
אני בו ז'וקין ויה, משקיקי נבגוקווי, דענש נאבי נוס ונאוון, קרי דיש נקונגו, גנאבה ג'ינג דון שבא, מקווה דורדם, ניגענין דון ג'נקי, קיצ'נן דאמין מפי ויהיין. Really happy to be here today. Welcome to the ניגענין podcast. And I'm joined by a special guest this week to talk about where Ngani'in came from or how it was started and the creation of the tribal council. So, Earl, would you like to introduce yourself?
Ani bojo kenewiya, ganadjwe gishik nene anishnabe nozun megazi dolem ganabiching donjaba wawin the magi win the junaki. Hello, my name is Earl Commander. I'm the executive director of Robinson here in Wawindamaguin, and I'm here today to give you all a brief history of the North Shore Tribal Council.
I'm so glad you could be here. For those of you who may not know, I actually get to spend a lot of time with Earl. He's my father. But I don't often get to talk about what he did. I know a lot of times when I was little, people had asked me, what does your dad do? And I would say, he goes to a lot of meetings, or I'm not really sure what he does. But as an adult and working in my community, working for First Nations in the Tribal Council area, and working for the Tribal Council, learning about things that he was involved with or initiated or was a part of has been really interesting for me, at least. So I'm glad he's here today to share a bit of that with us. So I guess the first part is, how basic should we go? Where is the Tribal Council located currently?
We are located on Serpent River First Nation, our headquarters. We do have branch offices in other communities in the town of Blind River, the city of Elliott Lake. But our primary location of North Shore Tribal Council is at the Serpent River First Nation.
All right. And that's on the beautiful north shore of Lake Huron in Ontario. So this is a tribal council that serves seven First Nations on the north shore between Sudbury and Sault Ste. Marie. So before we get into, I guess, like what services it provides or the how, I'd like to learn about the why it was created and when.
Okay. The Union of Ontario Indians has always had a region called a Robinson-Huron region. And really, it kind of represented North Shore, Highway 69, Manitoulin Island First Nations around the Lake Huron area. And we've, prior to that, I have always elected a Grand Council chief to represent our interests at the union level. But what was happening back in the late 70s, early 80s, it's a continuation of the relieving the federal government of their fiduciary responsibility for First Nations. And one of the things in Ontario region, what was happening is there was an attempt to move First Nations leadership into management positions at the regional office, while there were also downsizing the need for Indian affairs, as it was known. So Brian Mulroney, the Prime Minister of the day, developed this downsizing and devolution policy. I remember the Minister of Indian Affairs at the time said, David Crombie said, I will be the last Minister of Indian Affairs. And so with that sort of background, one chief in particular stands to mind in terms of trying to create what is called a super tribal council. That was Chief Ron Buzno from Garden River. He went to the chiefs and asked, if this is sort of the way we want to. We recognize federal government was trying to get out of the business. They were closing down the district offices like Manitowoc, like Sault Ste. Marie, and downsizing Sudbury. And so he proposed to the chiefs to create a treaty-wide tribal council. So this happened before the actual tribal council was made, right from around 1974 onwards. And I remember our chief at Serpent River was Peter Johnson. He was not successful because the United Chief and Councils were already working together as a tribal council work together on land claims. And at the time, it used to include Wiquomicog as part of the land claims work that they were doing. So that was what brought them together. But they soon came under that federal tribal council policy. And because of the lack of success, the North Shore chiefs said, well, if the chiefs aren't interested in a treaty-wide tribal council, let's take a look at a North Shore tribal council. And I remember Serpent River's role in that development quite well, even before I was a chief under Peter Johnson. We were already sharing some services for two or three of our communities. We were sharing education counselors with Mississauga. We were sharing a health nurse between the three communities. And certainly from those beginnings, we decided that we should create a North Shore Tribal Council. The name comes from Anishinaabe name, means the working together. And certainly from that perspective, Mamawesu was the name that was created. I remember the very first signing off of the, what do you call those things, letters patent for the creation of the not-for-profit corporation was just, at the time, three signatures. My signature, Keith Lewis' signature, and the chief of Batchewana, Doug Day, but just signature. And for years, that's just all we had was these not-for-profit. We take it out once a year, do our annual statement, appoint the auditors, do the financial audit, and then close the books and then carry on our business. But one of the things that happened initially was the chiefs have operated on their own constitution, like governance model, that looked at a representation from each of the seven First Nations. And originally, it wasn't even seven. It started off with five. So there were some pitches made to Whitefish River to see if they were interested. But they'd already decided to join with UCCM. Atikamekw, which is the far eastern end of the Tribal Council, they could have chosen to work with Iowa 69 communities, but eventually opted in to work with North Shore Tribal Council. And Batchewana First Nation was the other ones. And so, you know, reluctantly, some of those outlying communities decided that, it was to their advantage to join. So under the Tribal Council policy, you can have as minimum as two or three First Nations work together, which means you got less funding. Five First Nations working together, you got a little bit more funding. But seven or eight or nine First Nations worked together, you got the maximum funding under that Tribal Council policy. That was one of the very, very first proposals that was initiated to get the Tribal Council off the ground. In terms of that process, we never even had any money to meet as chiefs, so we piggyback our meetings on other meetings like the Union of Ontario Indians or the Chiefs of Ontario. And sometimes we couldn't even afford a meeting room. We had our meetings in the lobby of the hotel or inside the bar. And so it took a while for us to begin to get some funding in place. But once we did, then we started to sort of move forward. One of the interesting things that happened in the beginning as well was the issue of child welfare. There was a survey that was done by the Ontario Native Women's Association that looked at family violence as an issue. And so they had that survey said like 30% of all First Nation communities experienced some form of family violence. The women of our communities began to talk to each other about this. And they did kind of like their own assessment, their own survey, and they found that family violence was more like 50% in each of our communities along the North Shore. You know, I think that the chief says, well, we don't want to lose any more of our kids. So they made a decision to do some work about creating a child welfare agency. So Naugatuck-Winneman was born out of that. As well, the federal government was interested in building a Northeastern Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center in this area. Initially, when we started to work with this, we worked with Temagami First Nations, along with the Seven First Nations, in terms of developing what is now called Ben Bawapka. And so there was funding for capital, there was funding for operations of that treatment center, and that was one of the first successful initiatives that were taken on by the tribal council. As we grew, we hired a lot of people. The tribal council policy had created really was the tech services organization, and we actually did some creative stuff with tech services. We took the engineering portion of those budgets from Indian Affairs and combined it with UCCM's engineering portion, and we had our own engineering services for the two tribal councils. I remember the guy who used to work for Indian Affairs was the one that was brought over from Indian Affairs to work with us as an engineer. And we were providing services to our more than a dozen First Nations through that body. So some creative thinking there. And as we move forward with the tribal council, we also recognized that what was happening nationally was the repatriation of the Constitution. And so with that repatriation, of course, there was this push for what is called the third order of government in Canada. While we never got that recognition in the Constitution as being a third order of government, there was the Section 35 that said Indian, Inuit, Métis have rights that are affirmed within the Constitution. So what came out of that, though, was we are not prepared to give you full self-government recognition, but we are prepared to look at developing with you institutions of self-government. So that led to a self-government initiative for the Seven First Nations back in the 80s, early 90s. And, I think in terms of taking a look at that development, we have to sort of say that was a very instrumental relearning of our responsibility. The other interesting thing that was happening in terms of health was, it came from a policy called Indian Control of Indian Health, but really it was a devolution of some of that, what they call the secondary level of services from Indian Inuit Health Branch. And health transfer was the key buzzword of the day. And so we talked to each of the Seven First Nations about this initiatives. And my area of portfolio responsibility was held. And so naturally, I was leading the charge about increasing health services to our communities. And that was another major area. We went from three nurses to a nurse in each of the communities. We were able to hire a health director. We were able to get into some other initiatives there. So today, Mamoezing is a separate, the incorporated body, getting 90% of their funding now from the province. And I think when I take a look at sort of the creation of the other services outside of the tech services unit, we were able to get some environmental dollars to work on some of those environmental issues within our tribal council area. We were also able to get some economic development dollars. So there was some initiative, some funding and some initiatives around that. So we had a very robust, strong economic development unit within the tribal council. One of the big areas, of course, was forestry. In those early years, forestry was something that some of the chiefs really wanted to sort of get more involved in. So they created the Robinson Huron Forestry Company. But we were hoping, from an economic development perspective, to work with the province on having our own hardwood birch plywood industry. And so the province was willing to give us the allocation of those top pieces of the hardwood birch that aren't being used by other mills for us to use in a proposed mill. And so, you know, there was lots of work at trying to move this whole thing forward as an economic development. And the municipalities just loved us. We were creating jobs in Blind River. We were creating jobs in the area. And so it soon became recognition that North Shore Tribal Council would be the body, the governing body, because we were talking about self-government in the region, that would choose, for example, the trustees on the education board. They still do that. Choose the trustees that would sit for Wabatec as an economic development Aboriginal financial institution. And so, I think some of the things that have occurred within the tribal council area was due to the work that they were doing on self-government. Pretty soon we were getting requests to sit on the health boards in the area, Blind River, Elliott Lake. We were getting invited to be part of the chambers of commerce of Blind River, Elliott Lake. We were heavily involved in some of the sort of regional sort of things like the Elliott Lake North Shore, what they call ELNOS Fund, where, you know, money was put set up this financial institution due to the closure of the mines. And I think overall, we were also heavily involved in the Elliott Lake Initiative on creating an Indigenous arts school, White Mountain Academy of the Arts. And so likewise, there's been a lot of things that the Tribal Council has started, has been involved in, and it still exists. Some of it did not proceed to its end, like the self-government work. The chiefs, in their wisdom at the time, decided, no, we don't want to go that far down away from the Indian Act. And I guess in terms of now, as we move forward in a lot of different areas, in economic, social, health, the idea of Niigaanan also happened to happen at the same time that the province was considering, collectively dealing with a group of First Nations on social services versus individually having each one of our First Nations in the province deal with social services. So back then there was already sort of an interest in moving towards something like the Niigaanan program. And the chiefs readily understood that. We got to speak to our welfare administrators. We recognized we were under the 1965 welfare agreement for child welfare as well as social services. And we also recognized this aggregation of First Nations was something that Tribal Council was always about. Why they created Tribal Council in the first place was they didn't want to deal with each one of the First Nations individually. But in terms of taking a look at that now, I would say that this went on for about 20-year, first 20 years of Tribal Council that I was involved in. I was a chief for 20 years. I was chairman of the Tribal Council for 17 of those 20 years. And got to sort of actively be a part of all of the development of the Tribal Council through a lot of these initiatives. In fact, you know, I wrote some of those initial proposals for funding for Memoezewik, for the treatment center, for self-government, for the Tribal Council in and of itself. So this is where I had some good people working with me. A member from Serpent River First Nation, Keith Lewis. One of my childhood friends came on board. He started at Serpent River as a community planner, did the first draft for Serpent River of comprehensive community planning, and then went on to work at the Tribal Council and their environmental unit. And why environment was of particular interest to us is because of our community's impact by the uranium mines on the creation of the sulfuric acid plant. In our community, not just in our traditional territory. The mines are in our traditional territory, but that asset plant was built right on former leased land to a former lumber company back at the turn of the century. And so, you know, I think we were also interested on the health impacts that this had on our community members. A lot of our community members were dying of cancers. But at the same time, you know, I think we were still impacted by that site not being cleaned up. And so we hired a, oh, I don't know what she is, but she's a health expert. She was a gray nun, Dr. Rosalie Bertel. And she kind of like did a formal sort of survey. And we noticed that the health of our community was much worse off as a result of being that close to the uranium industry than our neighbors, Sagamook or Mississauga. And certainly from that perspective, the push for more health services was critical as far as our community was concerned. And likewise, I think in terms of taking a look at how the Tribal Council has been able to move forward, you see now a very strong technical services unit operate within the Tribal Council. You see a very strong health program within the Tribal Council. And you see the treatment center is now looking at another $12, $13 million new rebuild from the old lumber baron's mansion that we bought back in the day. We used to own one industrial park, the building there at one point. We've since sold it as a Tribal Council. But at the same time, you know, there is still a need for a lot of our services to be housed in each of our seven First Nations. And so we do have those offices for Nikaun and for health, for some of our other services in some way or aspect in seven of our Tribal Council communities. So, you know, we went from nothing to very quickly to $10 million. More recently to $40 million. Now I understand the budgets are getting closer to like $70 million overall with North Shore. So that being said, I think the Tribal Council has grown quite effectively over the last 30, 40 years that I've seen. I don't know if I've over-answered that initial question, but... that you asked for that history in a nutshell, you got it.
Right. Definitely lots of information in there. I was thinking of some of the things that maybe some of our listeners might want some clarification on. You mentioned UCCM a couple of times, and that's the United Chiefs and Councils of Manitoulin, which I think actually has changed recently.
Yes.
I don't know if you
mentioned. United Chief and Councils of Minising Menado.
I was wondering if we had skipped a step of what is a tribal council, but I think in your explanation of the First Nations working together and sharing resources and then pursuing the things jointly, and I think that hopefully clarified things along the way.
Certainly in terms of tribal council policy, it was... tried to copy some of the services that were normally delivered out of the district office, self-government services. So that position was fairly clear. Tech services, that position was fairly clear. Economic development services, that position was fairly clear. And then from there, you know, the title of the head of the tribal council was tribal administrator. It was... there are a couple of areas that we have not gotten into. We've added education as sort of, and education itself, because a lot of our communities, except for Sagamook, have provincial school board tuition agreements. But how do we begin to supplement those tuition agreements with services? And, you know, I know our community, they bus their kids either to the high school in Blind River or Elliott Lake, or the elementary kids all go there. And so you can see where there's going to be a need for Native as a second language, for example, that's in our school system, that's necessary. So, you know, asking for a seat on those boards was fairly critical to ensuring that those secondary educational services are being provided by those agreements. And over the years, as other First Nations pursue self-government, North Shore Tribal Council is being impacted by those self-government agreements. We're being sort of gradually chipped away as because it's not about increasing the pie, it's about slicing the pie differently. And so that's sort of what's happening there. The Tribal Council policy in terms of funding has never really changed over the last 20, 40 years. And so it's a very limited source of funding. So naturally, the Tribal Council had to do a lot more in these initiatives to generate the administration dollars necessary to support the management of all of these initiatives. Likewise, they're doing it again with the Robinson Year and Wawa the Magic. I think overall, when we take a look at new initiatives, I for the life of me never thought Niigaanan would do Indigenous Friendship Center in the city of Elliott Lake. But the health program did see us collaborate with Friendship Center in Sault Ste. Marie. The Tribal Council did the assets program, which is the employment and training dollars that became available. And I remember our economic development officers were heavily involved in that in the beginning. And now that's a pretty viable program under the Tribal Council. And they do provide training and dollars to each of our seven First Nations, as well as the city of Sault Ste. Marie. So while we are heavily focused in the Algoma region, two of our communities are within the Sudbury region. So they often have sometimes some differences there between the two. But, we've managed to make it work, even though it's crossing two district boundaries within our North Shore area. I don't know if that clarifies the question about funding.
Yeah, I guess what's coming clearer for me is I know when I worked for my home community or our home community here in Kanabaching, sometimes I used to wonder, what does the Tribal Council do? Because I couldn't see a direct line because I wasn't involved directly with the supports that were being offered. I know they had services we could tap into, like you shared already, tech services that supports housing and infrastructure, waste management, that kind of stuff. But as you're speaking and you mentioned devolution, I'm like, okay, so I sort of look at it from two sides. One side is devolution. So you've mentioned Ministry of Indian Affairs, which I think is gone through a few acronyms. Would that be ISC and CERN?
Yes. ISC primarily for UMBA.
So Indigenous Services Canada. They were controlling things and overseeing things and were heavily staffed. And so the devolution means the First Nations got together and created this organization or body where they would manage those things and flow money to the First Nations to deliver the services. Is that too general? Is that...
Well, when I use the term devolution, we also got to remember that each community was experiencing devolution. So there was a lot more. I mean, that's in the beginning. I mean, I was hired by the band back in the early 80s, late 70s, to be its economic development officer. And so all we did at the community level is, write all of those proposals for more responsibility, more services, we got the grant for the seniors' home. That was an easy one. We got the money for a health transfer that gave us the ability to hire our own health director beyond the nurse that was there. We took more and more responsibility for a lot of areas. I think that has allowed each of our communities to grow. At a regional level, I was also involved in the creation of the Ontario tertiary level service, the Ontario First Nations Technical Services Corporation. And so you could see where the federal government was not only sort of devolving things from a district office level, they're now looking at devolving public works type things to a regional body called Tech Services. And similarly, that was happening in health through the Chiefs of Ontario. So because health was of interest to me, we sat down with the province and the officer people and looked at the NDP government's Aboriginal Healing and Wellness Strategy, a $50 million strategy fund to look at not just health, but social services and other services that could be developed. So this is where Mamoeswin Health Program began pushing for those dollars to operate a health access center, for example. And so it was really taking advantage of devolution in a lot of different ways, but also negotiating for those dollars to come and flow not just to the community, but also to the tribal council or other area initiatives that benefit our work as First Nations. So that's kind of like what was happening. There's an interesting saying about Brian Mulrooney, and who just recently passed, is, you know, he was definitely doing this in a deliberate way as a way to devolve all responsibility from the federal government to the provinces. They call that the Buffalo Jump of the 1980s. First Nations have accepted that's what was happening. But at the same time, the other sort of thing is, there was lots of opposition to the 1969 white paper doing away with Indians. You can see from these initiatives that also is a key factor in what was happening here. We're becoming more and more like municipalities at the local First Nation level. Well, I think in terms of reasserting who we are as Anishinaabe, we have to sort of bring back that traditional sort of consideration as to who we are. This is where my present work at Wawindamagan relates to our relationship to the land, to the water, to the plants, to the animals. Our tech services are telling us that our health is being impacted by the aerial spraying on our hydro lines coming through our territory. We're experiencing a loss of our ability to hunt, trap, and gather because of industry sort of impacting that ability. And that all comes back to why the Tribal Council has taken quite an interest in being a part of the treaty sort of development as well, because they see that broader picture as being necessary. So that's kind of like where we're at and where the Tribal Council wants to go in terms of that, I don't know what you'd call it, regional self-determination, if that's what you want to call that.
So. Right. I like that you had mentioned at the beginning that you looked at it from treaty perspective and then reined it in, but we're back to seeing that bigger picture again, and, you know, maybe the timing is better now, and there's more capacity or desire for that to happen. So that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I take a look at the lands people. They say we have all kinds of development within our treaty territory, but we don't get the revenues from that. Some of the chiefs call that, you know, they owe us rent. Yet, you know, did we really get anything out of the $6 billion uranium mining industry in our traditional territory? We got an asset plant that left an impact on our community health-wise. We certainly could relieve the federal government of some responsibility. But we can never relieve the federal government of the impacts to our health as a result of that industry being in our backyard. I think there's a lot of things that opens up in terms of how do we begin to look at our communities. And it certainly has to be more than the postage stamp size of the reserve. You have to consider now the traditional territory as the basis for our homeland. And I think in terms of taking a look at this issue, most federal programs put a dividing line there is the reserve boundary, and all we're saying is, you know, no, our interests are outside of that boundary as well.
Yeah, all these weird lines drawn to delineate things, which I'm glad we are better able to convince folks or share our perspective that, right, that you drew that line, not us. So,
yeah, for sure.
Anything that we should know about the Tribal Council development that you didn't say? You said so much, though. I mean, I don't want to say, I'm not trying to invite you to go too broad or too deep. I'm just wondering if there's things that...
Well, one of the things that having been away and come back, is we spend an awful lot of our money paying for services to non-Indigenous, non-Anishinaabe institutions or organizations out there. Sagamook, for example, told me, I looked at the Tribal Council budget and I see $2.5 million was spent on training. And who gets all those monies? It's all those organizations outside there. How come we don't do our own training? I think what Niganan is doing, for example, there is bringing in services that have not been dreamed up of before, like Service Ontario. They're now pursuing Service Canada. And these are things most municipalities of any size would take for granted. A small example of that is in each of our communities, we now have a library. That wasn't there 40, 50 years ago. And what did it take to do that? Well, there was some lobbying done to get the province to say you need to more than just give a per capita grant to a small Indian village, small community. You need to supplement that with somebody's partial salary to keep a place open for a while. And all we had to do is write up a bank council resolution saying you accept the Public Libraries Act of Ontario and you get all these grants. And so having been involved in creation of a small resource center at Northern Ontario, I got involved in the regional library system and advocated for those First Nations that wanted to develop a library. I think those are small sort of victories that Tribal Council has been able to achieve over the years that I've been involved with the Tribal Council. And now I think these are being recognized quite strongly for who we are, and we've maintained those institutions that we built under the Tribal Council, through the Tribal Council, with the Tribal Council, they're gaining the recognition as being sort of an Indigenous-led, Anishinaabe-led organization that will make changes for the better for our people. So minimum odds win is what Niganan is all about. It's certainly about a lot of these programs that we have in terms of child welfare, health, drug and alcohol. And so that kind of philosophy has really been carried over now. And so I'm seeing that as well coming over to work on the treaty level. And so that experience has allowed me to sort of be as creative as I can be about how do we look at all of these things. I think one of our chiefs said it best. He says, I see the treaty as being sort of the parent organization to a lot of these initiatives at some point down the road. And I totally agree with that. I've seen it in 33, somewhat in 39, some of the prairies, treaties 6, 7, and 8, treaties 1, and treaties 2. So we've developed those relationships there with our treaty partners to share notes about all of this development. And we have some good people working with us to sort of advance some of those things for our own region.
Yeah, it's interesting to think of how First Nations have changed over the years and what services when I'm thinking about going way back to how we lived before colonization or before the creation of reserves and Indian Act and stuff, to those impositions and how restrictive it was and oppressive, to growing to today and the services we can offer and then what we want to offer, right? Yeah, interesting to think about.
A lot of our chiefs, recognize this is a creation of, tribal council is a creation of devolution. But they also recognize that some of these steps that they've taken in terms of advancing things like Niigaanit, like child welfare, is really sort of a stepping stone to, or building block to who we really want to be. Your involvement with Cook Nelson is a prime example of that. So I like the idea of people coming into the process, learning how it works, taking advantage of it, and then moving on to build it into what we want it to be, not necessarily what the program guidelines tell us it needs to be or should be.
And then just to jump back to Cook Nelson, that's supporting the Tribal Council project that supports First Nations developing their own child well-being law. But yeah, that's a good example too. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us today and sharing all that, taking notes furiously while you're doing that. Because I believe these are going to be connected to our speaker series, which we have available internally at Niigaanin for staff learning opportunities. Maybe we'll have you over there as well to share some of this with them. But Miigwech for spending time with us.
Sure. It was my pleasure.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And I hope you learned a lot or were able to take some of that in. It was a lot coming at you. So until next time, Miigwech.